Hello and welcome in.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning, you're listening to Science Mixtape, and this week, Star Wars 7, The Force Awakens, finally hit our screens! Joining me in the studio is physicist and huge Star Wars fan, Johnny O'Callaghan. Johnny has analysed the realities of many science fiction films, including Interstellar, The Martian, and Gravity. And this week, he's going to help us unpick the science of Star Wars. From lightsabers to Death Stars, hyperspace and space battles, are these things physically possible? We're going to be using a three-tier system created by Michio Kaku, which talks about different classes of impossibilities. So, class one is an impossibility where the technologies are impossible today, but they don't violate the known laws of physics, and we're probably quite close to them. So that's class one. Haven't got it yet, but just around the corner. Class two is a technology that sits at the very edge of our understanding of the physical world, but maybe in a million years we would be able to potentially create it. So time travel would be an example of that. Sort of just understand it, maybe we can have it. And then class three is an impossibility that violates the known laws of physics in our world. But that's not to say couldn't be different physical laws in other worlds. So there we go. That's how we will be looking at our science of Star Wars this week. Johnny, thank you for joining me in the studio.
No problem.
How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
What got you to be such a Star Wars fan in this first place?
Well, I'm a self-professed space geek. I love anything to do with space. So I think when I was a wee boy and the possibility of seeing this amazing space landscape laid out before me, I instantly became a massive fan.
It's all those kind of different worlds that are sort of similar and yet just so exciting and exotic and different. I mean, even the first one where it's got like two suns and two stars, you're just like, oh yeah, a sunset with two suns. It's amazing. Joining me also in the studio, we have producer Kyle.
Hey.
Kyle is going to be teaching us how we can make the blaster noise.
Yeah. What you're going to need to do is see if you can get hold of a paper cup and a slinky.
Metallic slinky, yeah.
Metallic slinky,
not
yeah.
Not those has plastic rainbow ones.
No, unfortunately the plastic ones won't work. But if you can get hold of a metal one, get those together, and then a bit later we'll be telling you how to put together a blaster sounder.
It's going to sound just like that. He'll also be reading us some special science facts after each of the songs. And now, coming on to the music, Johnny, you've chosen all the music for us today. What are we having first?
Well, all of my music today is obviously a space theme, in honour of Star Wars. So first, I just obviously had to pick Space Oddity by Bowie because it is the quintessential space song.
This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know whose shirts you wear.
Did you know it would cost $852 million billion dollars, or roughly 13,000 times the world's GDP, to build the Death Star, and that's just the cost of steel production?
Yeah, the Death Star. Massive, massive structure. Is that physically possible? Could we ever create something like the Death Star?
I think the answer really is yes, eventually. I mean,
so we're going to give it a class two. We understand it, and maybe in a million years' time.
I mean, our biggest structure at the moment that we've made in space is the ISS, which cost $100 billion so far to date, and that measures roughly about 300 feet across. Death Star, I think, is about 60 kilometers across. You can already see the logistics of scale there are pretty difficult.
Yeah.
And the big issue with running the ISS is we have to launch all of the material into space, all the modules and everything, and that, even for the ISS, is pretty difficult. So with the Death Star, I imagine they had some sort of crazy space system where they could launch everything up there. But one thing that's been touted we could do is use asteroids, which are meant to be rich in certain metals, platinum, bauxite, aluminium, things like that. And if we could utilize some of these asteroids, a lot of which are near Earth, it's possible you could use them to build giant space structures. This is obviously...
You could mine them.
Yeah. So there are actually two companies now, Deep Space Industries and Planetary Resources, who both are trying to mine asteroids. They're launching spacecraft in the coming years that will find asteroids to mine and take their resources. So that aside, building something that large is difficult but doable.
How close are they, do you think, to actually being able to mine an asteroid? And sort of, like, have they actually managed to land on an asteroid yet? Are we able to identify which ones are?
We have landed on an asteroid before, a Japanese spacecraft called Hayabusa in the early noughties. It cost $100 million and it returned 0.01 grams of the asteroid. So we're probably not going to be getting a lot of metal from an asteroid anytime soon.
0.01 grams.
Correct. And NASA has a new mission called OSIRIS-REx launching next decade, which costs about $300 million and that will return about 1 gram. So in terms of scale, we're pretty far off. But these companies are confident they are going to have spacecraft that will scour across the surface and collect loads of stuff in space, and it might happen.
Yeah, I also read that they were looking into sort of using asteroids as almost like fueling how do you pronounce it? Depots? That's the word. Thank you. Fueling depots. Because, you know, traveling to Mars already is going to take like months, years. And if you wanted to go any further, you'd run out of fuel unless you had like some intergalactic fuel depots.
That is partially the idea. What NASA are going to be doing longer term in the future is taking an asteroid and putting it in orbit around the moon. And astronauts will go and visit that asteroid and mine it themselves and then bring that material back to Earth. And that will be happening in the 2030s. And you might think that sounds ridiculous, but all the steps are being taken for that to happen at the moment.
2030s.
I think space miner would be a pretty cool job title, right? I'd like to be a space miner.
I'm just picturing astronauts with like pickaxes.
That's essentially what it's going to be, I think. I actually visited NASA's headquarters recently, and they have a vehicle there that's going to be used to go up to an asteroid, and the astronauts will be inside. It's like got a big glass front, and they have giant arms on the side, and it will grab the asteroid, and then they'll go out on a spacewalk and go up with pickaxes and chip away little bits and study them on the spacecraft and come back to Earth.
So it's just going to, this machine is just going to grab an asteroid?
Essentially, NASA's original plan was to get a giant bag and put it around, I'm not kidding, they were going to get a giant bag and put it around an asteroid and move it into orbit around the moon. Now instead,
it's like almost like a net, like sweeping it out of its own orbit.
Yeah, so there are lots of asteroids in near Earth orbit, NEA asteroids, which aren't a threat to us but are accessible, and they were going to get one of these, and yes, with the giant net, move it slightly closer. Instead, now they're going to land a spacecraft on the surface of an asteroid, pick up a big rock, and move it into orbit around the moon. I'm not entirely keen on that idea, but that's what their plan is going to be.
That's crazy. And speaking of asteroids, now that is something that in the Star Wars films is not possible. There's this epic sequence in the first film where they are having a space fight, flying through an asteroid, and they're twisting and turning and dodging, and there are rocks all around them crashing into each other. Now, why is that not realistic?
Well, that was actually Empire Strikes Back. I hate to correct your Star Wars knowledge.
I'm so sorry,
I'll let that one slide. But we obviously have an asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, which would have been a fully fledged planet if not for Jupiter tearing apart what was a planet and forming this huge amount of asteroids.
Because its gravitational pull was so strong.
Exactly, yeah. But asteroids in this belt, in Empire Strikes Back, they're portrayed as being a few meters apart, really close, and the Millennium Falcon ducks and weaves through, and the Empire can't follow them. In reality, asteroids are about thousands of miles apart, millions of miles apart. If you land on one asteroid, you would be nowhere near another one. The space between them is so vast that you could send a Death Star through the asteroid field without having any problems.
Wow.
I don't think Millennium Falcon would have been wholly successful in our solar system outrunning the Empire.
So you almost can't see the other asteroids around you.
Oh, completely. I mean, even you couldn't even see an asteroid from a few miles away. I mean, they're not big, and space is very dark, so they're not very reflective. They have a low albedo. Hey,
that's a really good point, yeah. Because everything that we see has to, like, we can only see it because it's reflecting light.
Exactly. Whereas a comet is made of ice, water, ice, and that reflects a lot of sunlight. Like you saw, I don't know if you've seen the ESA's Rosetta mission with the Philae lander.
Landing on the comet.
On Comet 67P.
And then having a little sleep until they got enough sun to wake up again.
But so that comet, even then, that was very hot. They have to really up the contrast in the images to see it. But that is visible thanks to all the sunlight reflecting off the water ice. On an asteroid, it's mostly made of rock and metal. So it doesn't look very pretty or of anything at all, even from right up close.
And one thing that I found really cool about asteroids is we think of them always as just big lumps of rock, but actually some of them are just like clumps of rubble held together by their like mutual gravity.
Essentially, yeah, and it's how
it's like a kind of shell of tiny, tiny rocks.
It is, yes, yeah, accretion and coalition. How it's basically how we think planets formed, where little bits slowly gathered together and grew over time, little pebbles, and then we formed things like the Earth. Asteroids are essentially failed planets or pieces of protoplanet that didn't form a planet. And they are, if you imagine all those asteroids coming together and they would form one planet, in the case of our asteroid belt, they are just spread out little bits that never had the chance to form an exciting 10th planet of our solar system, or 9th planet, sorry, Pluto.
Pluto was a planet when I was a kid. And we mentioned earlier in this unrealistic asteroid belt with the rocks all around you, loads of jeopardy, that the spaceships are sort of banking and turning. And actually, that they wouldn't be able to fly like that, would they?
That's probably the, well, I don't say the least realistic bit, but that's the bit of Star Wars that is, I'd say, class 3 in Michio Kaku's scenario.
Impossibilities.
You're never going to be able to create a spacecraft that can bank and turn through space like a plane, which is obviously how it's exactly portrayed in Star Wars.
Yeah.
I mean, even,
now, why is that?
Well, in space with essentially no gravity and being in a vacuum, any force you push on something, that space, the object will continue to move in that direction. So if I'm out floating in space and someone pushes my arm, I'm going to start spinning left. So if you have a spacecraft and you try and turn it left, it's just going to start spinning. It's not going to grab onto the air like a plane would. So if you're trying to do a banked turn, just by firing your thrusters and trying to move the spacecraft will still continue moving forwards. There's nothing to stop it. There's no air for it to move against. And you'll just have this wildly spinning out of control spacecraft that is not able to turn at all. I think the only way you could have some sort of banking system is if you had about 1,000 thrusters on a spacecraft to...
Yeah, and so like maybe one was firing more than another, but it was like a counterforce.
Yeah, yeah. There's actually quite a cool mission coming up soon that I think ESA are launching. I can't remember the name now, but it's to test, to look for gravitational waves, which are meant to be really small fluctuations in space-time caused by colliding black holes. And they have this spacecraft that they've just launched that has loads of thrusters on it, and it's going to release two gold cubes inside, and it's going to allow them to be suspended in space by moving the spacecraft around the cubes. But they're using this advanced thruster system that no one's ever used before to make sure the gold cubes don't touch the side of the spacecraft. Not sure I explained that super well, but that's an illustration.
So it's almost like the cubes are inside the spacecraft, and using the thrusters, they're going to make sure they never hit the edges.
Correct, yeah.
Yeah, you explained it perfectly.
Excellent. But that's an example of how difficult it is to move something or to get something in the exact direction you want, because this thing has tens of thrusters that will be ensuring they never touch the sides.
Pathfinder. Yeah, LISA Pathfinder. That's the name of the mission.
Correct. Yeah. I knew that. That was just a test.
Producer Carl is on it. Yeah, so if you look at the movements of the little space jet fighters or the bigger ships, apparently the little ones do work just like planes on our planet. That's kind of what they've been modelled on. And the bigger ones work as if they were naval ships, sort of slower and bulkier, as if they were moving through the water, kind of gliding along.
Yeah, I think Star Wars is essentially a mix of land and air and sea in space rather than actual space flight.
Indeed. All right, time for another song. What do you want next?
Let's go for Starlight by Muse.
Excellent choice.
Did you know the lightsaber sound is a combination of the hum of an idling 35mm movie projector and the feedback generated by passing a stripped microphone cable next to a television?
And we'll be having some more sound effects later when you learn how to make the blaster noise. But yeah, lightsabers, possibly the most iconic thing about Star Wars. The sound, the look of them, the fights they have. Is this something that we could ever create? And how do we think it works?
Lightsabers are awesome and probably the best thing about Star Wars. But unfortunately, in the current laws of physics, having something of that high energy and temperature in a sword-like shape is beyond any of our realms of understanding at the moment. You never know, there could be some big breakthrough in the future. But for now, they're a little bit fanciful. I mean, the big issue is how, if you've seen Star Wars, which I'm sure you will have, They're able to cut through any material, flesh or metal or whatnot, except another lightsaber.
Yeah, so this is like crazy. If we think that they are possibly lasers, then that's just light, and light beams don't clash. They go through each other.
Correct, and I'm not sure of any way you can make light into this powerful beam of energy that is essentially solid. I mean, light, as you say, is a particle slash wave. There isn't really a way you can turn it into a solid object.
So people, like, you can use a laser to cut things. So people use, like, big, powerful lasers to cut metal. But the problem is you shine it onto the thing and it will just destroy the thing. And as soon as the thing disappears, the light continues. And it keeps going on forever and ever. And it doesn't just stop.
But that's the other issue. I mean, how do you create this
thing that's only like a meter and a half long?
Yeah, this intense source of energy that suddenly stops in the middle of the air without any barrier against it. You'd have to somehow create particles that decay over like a distance of 60 centimeters or something, which...
Oh, that's quite clever.
I mean, I'm just plucking that out of the air, but maybe there is some way you could do that, but it would be difficult.
Because I was thinking to get something strong enough, you would need it to be reflecting back on itself and building up kind of intensity as the waves reflect back and forth. So you would need a reflector thing at the end of your lightsaber.
Oh, yeah. Potentially, if you had some sort of handle stick device with a pole coming out of it with a reflector at the end, and you're firing intense particles up into this reflector and coming back again, you can maybe make something that looks like a lightsaber, and maybe there is some way you could make a large amount of energy that would, it would be hot to touch, and maybe it would be hot enough to melt something or cut into something. I don't think you quite get the same effect of a fully fed lightsaber, but I think that could potentially work.
So we're giving it class 2?
I'll give it a class 2.
Yeah, we sort of understand it. Maybe in a million years we'll be controlling lasers in that way.
In a galaxy far, far away.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about was hyperspace and their ability to travel faster than the speed of light. Is that what they're doing?
Correct. So they're warping space and time to travel huge distances, which if you've seen any other sci-fi shows, Star Trek or Firefly or whatnot, they all have their own ways of describing warp travel, and it's something that has got a huge amount of research and attention in recent years. One thing that got a lot of attention was NASA created something called an EM drive. Well, it's this hypothetical drive that could potentially go faster than the speed of light. Some people would say it's a bit of a floozy area at the moment, but warp travel itself is very interesting in that it relies on you bending space-time, so you appear at a destination faster than you would if you'd just gone through normal space. There's a famous NASA scientist called Dr. Harold White who came up with an idea for how it could be possible. It's based on a Mexican physicist called Miguel Alcubierre. It's called the Alcubierre drive. And how it works is that it bends space-time. This spacecraft has like a ring around it, high amount of energy, and creates like a mini wormhole from one point in space to another point in space. And it is entirely theoretical at the moment, any sort of warp travel or hyperspace. But it's nice to think that it's not beyond completely the realm of understanding.
Yeah, so I thought the Alcubierre drive is this weird, it's almost like that it creates a wave like on the ocean, so it builds up lots of space behind it and slants the spaceship forward, so it's sliding along on this wave, but the distortion is not on the surface of the water, it's actually in space itself, and inside the little bubble the space is normal, just so you could live in it and be fine, but outside it generates this kind of wave of space that pushes you along really quickly.
Essentially, yeah. And if you've seen Interstellar, the portrayal of warp travel in Interstellar is, some people think, similar to how we think it would work. So in Interstellar, they have this giant sphere around the spacecraft and it creates this wormhole and it travels to a different solar system. But the physics of how it travels in this sphere in that film is potentially what it might look like. To clarify, though, warp travel is definitely not something that is possible at the moment or that we know could happen, but people have, of course, theorized of how it would be possible.
It's not against the laws of physics.
Not entirely. But it brings up another issue, though, in that maybe we'll talk about this later, but if warp travel is possible, the universe has been around for 13.8 billion years. Humanity has been around for, you know, only a few thousand years. But if warp travel is possible, why have we not seen anyone else in the universe traveling around beyond the speed of light? Why has no one ever visited us or come to our solar system? Mm. We're just one planet among billions in our own solar system, in our galaxy, sorry, in billions of other galaxies. Surely if warp travel is possible, we'd see massive civilizations across the galaxy, across the universe. But so that is one of the slightly more depressing thoughts in that either we're alone in the universe or warp travel
doesn't
exist.
The chances of intelligent life happening are so small. Even if there's life out there, the chances that it's intelligent life are minuscule as we understand it. So I don't think it's necessarily that surprising that another civilization hasn't created warp travel yet. Equally, it could be like Doctor Who, and if anyone has visited us, they just kind of mind wipe us and leave again.
And just abduct a couple of people and probe them and then send them back to Earth.
And casually sort of save the planet, but don't want any glory.
Nobody believes them.
Yeah, create crop circles and then fly away again, just to give us a hint.
Well, what a great time to have your next song, which is Contact by Daft Punk.
As we look back at the Earth, it's up at about 11 o'clock, about maybe 10 or 12 Earth diameters. I don't know whether that does you any good, but there's something out there.
Did you know Ewok language is a combination of Tibetan and Nepalese? The Jawas spoke sped-up Zulu, and the character Greedo speaks an electronically distorted form of Quechua dialect of Peru.
Did not know that.
And actually, that roar that we've just heard there, they used 7 different animals to create Chewie's voice and his roar. Bears, lions, camels, badgers, walruses, tigers, and surprisingly, rabbits are all included in his voice.
You know how they made the velociraptor sound in Jurassic Park, right?
No.
That's 2 turtles having sex.
Oh, wow.
That's an interesting one.
Well, this is the part of the show where we're looking at the science of the Star Wars sound effects. So, maybe not quite as raunchy as that, but we do have a few more. Everyone knows that Darth Vader's classic breathing was a microphone in a scuba mask. But yeah, we're going to teach you how to make the blaster noise. So as Carl said at the top of the show, all you need is a paper cup and a metal slinky.
Yeah, so what you want to do is take your paper cup, or polystyrene cup works just fine, and carefully make a small hole in the bottom of the cup, and then you want to take the end of the slinky and feed it through the hole and give it a couple of turns, so the end of the slinky is kind of stuck into the cup, and then let the slinky go underneath the bottom of the cup and it's going to fall down, and then what you just do is hit your hand onto the bottom of the slinky and it generates a blaster sound.
Crazy. I mean, listeners at home, that is just Kyle with a slinky and a cup hitting the bottom of the slinky, and it's sort of vibrating up through it. Why is it making that noise? Do you know how it works?
Yeah, so the reason that it does this is because of the different way that different frequencies of sound waves travel. So when I hit the bottom of the slinky, it's kind of like clapping in air. A clap is this sound where there's lots and lots of frequencies in it. So a clap is full of lots and lots of frequencies. But when you hear the sound, you only hear the sound when the sound reaches the cup, and then in the cup, the sound becomes amplified and you can hear it. But the high frequencies that are traveling through the slinky travel faster than the low frequencies. So when you hear it, you'll hear it where it starts high and then goes low. So that kind of... The sound, you're hearing the high frequencies first and then the low frequencies, and it gives you that blaster sound.
That is amazing. A couple more really cool sound effects for you. The screech of the sort of jet fighters as they go past was a mix of a car driving on a wet road and an elephant scream. And hyperspace, that we were just talking about, was 2 recordings of a jet played out of sync. Giving you that warped feeling.
Wow.
Indeed.
It's amazing though, because that's the thing. None of these ships would make any sound, right?
Exactly. Impossible in space.
Correct.
Johnny, will you tell us why?
Well, there are no particles and there is no air in space. So, unfortunately, the grand space battles that you see in Star Wars, although very exciting, would be deathly silent affairs with, as we previously explained, awkwardly turning spacecraft trying to point towards each other. A popular science fiction show called Firefly handles this very well. In the show, there is absolutely no sound in space, and all of the action in the film is done in complete silence, and it's got a lot of plaudits for it. But no sound can travel in space at all. Light can travel through space, as particles of light can propagate quite easily through the interstellar medium. But for sound, it needs airwaves to vibrate the air. And
needs particles to be able to pass that vibration on.
Correct, and there is just nothing of that sort in space, unfortunately. When astronauts are out on spacewalks, they have obviously headsets in their ear and things, so they are able, and you can communicate across space. You can,
and because within their helmets, they're obviously breathing oxygen and there's air in there, so within their helmets they can hear.
Yeah, so it's not silent for them. But if you were standing near an astronaut with no helmet on and you could somehow survive for a little while, you wouldn't hear anything at all. He would just be going about his business in complete silence. So I'm afraid no sound in space.
Well, we're going to play your next song. But after this, we are going to be giving Johnny a little test. So Channel 5, fantastically, to sort of mark Star Wars being released, their weather report that day, I don't know who writes it, but they managed to squeeze in loads of Star Wars puns. So we will be playing this after the song and seeing how many Star Wars puns Johnny can spot. We'd also like to know how many you can spot. So if you want to tweet us at Soho Radio and let us know how many you found, or tweet us your own Star Wars puns if you can come up with a better one. Johnny, what's your next song going to be?
It is by The Killers, I believe, and it is Spaceman.
Did you know, to create the iconic Star Wars opening credits, the real method was they had a camera moved slowly across a glossy printed plate which measured about 6 feet long.
I did not know that.
Yeah, everyone thinks they did it by graphics, but in the original one, they just did it with a camera.
That's so cool. Right, so are you ready, Johnny? Are you prepped? Have you got your pun head on?
I am ready.
Okay, so this is the Channel 5 weather forecast with a very special Star Wars twist.
There. Well, it's another unusually mild day today with a layer of cloud covering the UK. But if you look farther west, you will be seeing a glimmer of sunshine if you're lucky. However, there will be a fairly light breeze. The force is strong, though, for northern Scotland. And then tonight, the weather strikes back as a deep area of low pressure pushes in from the west, creating storm-like conditions for Northern Ireland and western Scotland. Don't be a trooper. Please take care on the roads. Could be difficult driving conditions. Now, if you're forced to awaken early tomorrow morning, it will be on the dark side, but as you can see, fairly mild with temperatures in double digits. Far, far away towards the southeast of England, there's a new hope for some sunshine developing in the afternoon.
How many did you get?
I only got 9. I hope that's the total.
I got 9. I think there was 9.
I got 9 as well.
Yeah!
Was that?
I think they had 10, but I can't find the 10th. No. So if any listeners out there can spot a 10th, do let us know. What was your favourite?
I like The Force Awakened, but I love a delivery of it. I think it's amazing. Yeah. A lot of pun things you hear, very...
over the top, and they like really exaggerate it. I mean, I'm guilty of that myself.
I like the cloud layer. I thought that was very well done.
Which one was that?
Cloud layer.
No.
Leia.
I didn't...
Princess Leia.
Okay,
cloud
so
layer.
I didn't get that one, so there's the 10th for me.
Yeah, that is also my 10th. I didn't get that one either.
I must have missed another one then.
Well done, producer girl. My favourite is the Luke Father. If you Luke Father West... amazing. So our final kind of topics on Star Wars, artificial gravity.
So the big thing in the film, not the big thing, but in every spacecraft they're in, on the Death Star, in their X-Wings and TIE fighters, they're all just sitting there comfortably and not floating around. If you've ever seen astronauts in the ISS, you'll know that everything floats in space. There's no artificial gravity machine that could let you do that on a spacecraft. So that in itself is quite unrealistic. I mean, to create artificial gravity in space and to have it like a Earth-like gravity force, you need to really spin a spacecraft. You can't... Gravity itself comes from really massive objects, sort of, in a sense. So Earth right now is pulling us down towards the ground. So unless you have something, the mass of Earth in your spacecraft, you're not going to have some sort of gravity that could hold you there. So the idea that we'll be using in the future is to have spacecraft that spin to create this gravity. On one of the Gemini missions in the 1960s, one of NASA's early space missions, they attached a spacecraft to a rocket booster with a giant cable, and they spun the spacecraft and the rocket booster around each other, and they created about 0.001 G of force. But it was enough to prove that it is possible. So,
oh wow!
So if you've seen The Martian, in that film, they create artificial gravity by having a big spinning structure around the central like pillar of habitability, and that spinning structure on that, if you spin it at the right rate, you're pushed backwards, like a fairground ride where you're sort of pushed backwards and you're smack in your seat.
If you're on like a really fast one, you sort of sat next to someone and then you kind of all get squished on top of each other.
Correct. So
thrown towards the outside.
This same design, when we eventually go to Mars in the 2040s, hopefully, we'll be using, well, I'm predicting 2041, but
Wow. Okay. You heard it here first on Soho Radio, 2041 even.
Yeah, we don't talk about the 1941 mission. That was the secret Mars mission.
Would you think they could, that the Death Star itself would be big enough to have gravity?
So the Death Star, as I mentioned earlier, is about 60 kilometers across. You would have a bit of gravity, but if you go and stand on an asteroid that's 60 kilometers across, you're not going to be pulled towards the surface with the same force they are on a Death Star. I'm assuming on the Death Star they have some sort of futuristic technology at the center that is creating a huge amount of gravity. That's what I like to believe. So I'm sure they have some sort of fanciful system, but no, the mass alone of the Death Star wouldn't let you walk around like you were on Earth.
So we're going to give it a class 2 for artificial gravity.
Give it a class 2 at a push.
Yeah, brilliant. And then the final question, aliens. There are a lot of aliens in Star Wars.
Correct, and we touched on this earlier. So in the warp travel part, so the big issue at the moment is the Fermi paradox in space, where if life is so abundant, then how come we've never heard from anyone? So either we are alone in the universe, we're the first on the scene. There's a lot of possibilities. But in the Star Wars universe, you have aliens from all walks of life.
Mm.
Why haven't we managed to find anything yet, which is one of the big problems in science? But we're actually on the cusp of finding something. If you talk to people at NASA, they are very confident of a discovery pretty soon, in the next 2 decades, really, in our solar system. So we think microbial life could exist on several locations, possibly on the surface of Mars, possibly underneath the icy crust of Jupiter's moon Europa, or Saturn's moon Enceladus. Now, this life in our solar system will be tiny. It will be microbial. It will be small, very difficult to detect, which is another issue. We don't have a life detection machine. There is no instrument we can send to another world, and it could pick up a bit of icy crust or soil and go, there's loads of life here.
Mm.
We just don't, without a human being there, we can't do that at the moment.
And there's also the idea that we only know how to look for the life that we understand.
That's true.
So we tend to look for carbon-based things, or maybe silicon-based, possibly. But I was always struck by, in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Douglas Adams describes one alien as being a supremely intelligent shade of the colour blue. I just found that amazing, that you could just have an intelligent colour. And that sort of life, we would never know how to find that, or even how to look for it.
Correct. And there could very well be life as we don't know it. And that is a question I do get asked a lot when I'm talking to people about aliens, as stupid as it sounds. But people are always like, oh, why are we just looking for life as we know it? But the issue is, we don't know what other life looks like, so we can't really look for something we don't know exists. There are some theories. So on Titan, which is a moon of Saturn, massive moon, and it's the only other body in the solar system that has the only other world in the solar system with bodies of liquid on its surface. But whereas Earth has water, Titan has big lakes of methane and ethane, which are poisonous and would kill us if we were there. But people have theorized that there could be life on Titan that could survive on methane somehow, whereas we use oxygen and carbon dioxide to survive. This life might be methane based and might be able to survive in those oceans and lakes there.
In the same way that you get bacteria down at sort of sulfurous vents of volcanoes under the sea.
Correct, yeah. And one thing we find on Earth is that we find life everywhere. I mean, literally everywhere. In Antarctica, at the bottom of a volcano, underneath the ocean, life is absolutely everywhere. So if there is a chance life could exist in another world, we would think that it could also adapt to almost any environment. Extremophiles, these things are called. Life that can go absolutely anywhere. You get an alien come to Earth and it plucks soil and it will be teeming with life and it will know immediately that Earth is habitable.
Mm. It's like the other week we were talking about viruses and how...
But we have had a few near misses in terms of alien discoveries. There was the WOW signal in the 1970s. I don't know if you know who SETI are, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Yes, so a scientist working with SETI was observing a distant point in the universe, and this signal came back that he couldn't explain. It's a series of numbers on the screen, like 6766 or something, I can't remember exactly. But he circled it with a big wow exclamation mark, because this was, he thought, potentially, there was no known source for it. There was no star in that direction, no planet, no galaxy. So he thought, well, it could very much be some sort of signal coming from somewhere else. it was never confirmed and never followed up, so we don't know for sure. And then a Mars meteorite fell on Earth in the 1990s, or they found it in the 1990s, that had what looked like fossilized bacteria inside it. It was such big news at the time that President Clinton even gave a presidential address announcing that they may have discovered alien life. It was later widely discredited, and numerous studies tore apart this research and said it was ridiculous. But there was a very small, tantalizing possibility that that meteorite contained life from Mars. I don't think it did, but it shows you the furor that would be created if even some sort of detection was made. And that is NASA's big issue now. So they're in what they call the second wave of exploration. So first we found these worlds like Europa, Titan and whatnot. Mm. Now we're sending spacecraft there to work out if they are habitable, if life could exist on them. And then a third wave, which will be in maybe in the 2030s or 40s, will be to actually send stuff to the surface and make direct detections of life. The issue, as I mentioned, though, is we don't know what to look for at the moment. We don't know how. Well, if we can find out that life started two separate locations in our solar system alone, that would have massive. That would essentially mean there must be other life in the universe. I mean, if our own solar system, which is fairly standard, I mean, it's a bunch of planets around a really nondescript star, but if we can form life on two separate worlds, there must be countless other solar systems that can do the same thing.
So this is definitely a class one.
Definitely class one.
We're pretty sure there are going to be some aliens out there. And then the final element of class one, when I was trying to think, do we have anything that is in Star Wars that we've already created? We're pretty close with our artificial intelligence and our robots.
I do believe they think I am some sort of god.
You know, when Luke loses his hand and he has a sort of cyborg arm attached, we're pretty close with our prosthetics as well.
Very true. Bionic limbs and whatnot are here. We have bionic eyes, we have bionic arms. Robert Downey Jr. this year gave a boy who had lost his arm an Iron Man hand that was bionic and he could control it. I mean, bionic limbs are very, very much here.
And we've even got medical cases where I don't quite understand how the technology works, but just by thinking, they were able to operate a hand that wasn't attached.
Yep, that's a new big thing. So whereas before your hand might have been difficult to control, yes, you now can literally wire your brain into these devices now and they can be controlled. It's pretty incredible.
Maybe that's how we'll get a real world force.
Well, you mentioned AI as well, though. That is the next big thing as well. If you talk to Elon Musk or Stephen Hawking, they both say that artificial intelligence is one of the biggest threats facing humanity, because we're going to be creating machines that can think for themselves, are out for themselves, can work out for themselves how to best to survive. Obviously, they will be designed to help humanity, but there is some scenario down in the future that where it gets a bit ethically difficult, where we're creating AI life and it might have a mind of its own.
Countless science fiction films love this. Correct. Love this dilemma.
Goodness gracious me.
What are we going to be listening to as your next song?
Well, appropriately, as we've been talking about planets, I think we should go for Every Planet We Reach Is Dead by The Gorillaz.
Dreams are bad, our heads are mad. I love the girl, but God only knows it's getting hard. See the sun coming through. I love you. But what are we going to do?
Well, other than the amazing science news, that's our Star Wars film that's released. What piece have you brought with you today, Johnny?
Well, today I wanted to talk about Tim Peake's launch into space. He is the first official British astronaut, massive quotation marks around official, and he reached the ISS at the end of this week, and he is now aboard.
I know. I was actually down at the Science Museum.
I was there too.
Were you? Yeah, where they did stargazing live. We saw the kind of first phone call, saw him going into the hut. You felt like you were part of history. It was a phenomenal moment.
It was amazing. I think there is a small amount of discredit done to the other British astronauts, though. Helen Sharman in 1991 was the first ever British astronaut. And since then, we have had six or seven that have gone in space as well. But they all took dual UK-US citizenship and one dual UK-South African to join other space agencies and get into space. Michael Fove, for example, went up about 10 years ago, and he is the most British man you'll ever meet. But
he had an American flag on his space
suit. He did have an American flag, correct. Whereas Tim Peake is wholly sponsored by our own government through the European Space Agency. So,
and also, newspapers just love a headline. First official sounds better than eighth, doesn't it?
It does sound better. I've seen him, he's been given about 10 different labels, so I think we'll let him have it. But
So I heard that his first meal in space was a hot bacon sandwich.
Delicious.
And that he said that he was really struck, like he was expecting to see the little blue dot, like everyone knows, we've seen images of what the planet looks like, but that actually when you look the other way and you just see nothing, he wasn't prepared for how black space is. He's just like, it's the blackest black, quote unquote.
You mentioned astronaut food there. Astronaut food has come a huge way since the early missions. When in the 60s they used to go up with little packets and different things. Now you have proper food on the spacecraft, so they have actual like bits of meat and fruit and whatnot. So you essentially fully fledged meals up there.
And they can take up their own food. So they have a bit of space to take stuff up. So they can take up, you know, their favourite brand of peanut butter if they want.
Didn't he take up loads of tea?
Yeah.
Two astronauts actually in the 60s were massively reprimanded. One of them snuck a corned beef sandwich into the spacecraft. And as he took it out of his spacesuit, it disintegrated entirely. And NASA were not amused because this was one of their first ever spacecraft. And this guy had snuck a corned beef sandwich onto it. And I don't think they ever flew again. So... word of warning, don't do that.
Yeah, it's really hard to get the smell of corned beef out.
Especially if it's floating around you. And then the bit of science news I saw, not at all space-themed, but kind of Christmassy, polar bears. After 45 years of field observation on the Western Hudson Bay group of polar bears, they've been studying them since 1966, looking at their family tree genetic data and how they are kind of linked. They found one case of identical twins. So most polar bears will have twins, but they've actually found one case of identical twins, which is really, really cool. And one case of incest between a pair of half siblings, and six adoptions, which is really unusual in the animal world, because why would you bring up someone else's cub if it's not got your genes? And they think there might be two reasons for this. One might just be a case of mistaken identity, where, you know, the cub has just confused its wandered off from its mom and found another one, and that if a female already had some cubs, to quote, we don't know yet whether polar bears can count, so she might just have not noticed that she had to feed three rather than two. And then the other sadder explanation is that in four of these cases it was with a adoptive mother who was alone, so she may have lost her babies and then just been primed to rear and then come across another one. So there we go. We are completely out of time. Thank you so much, Johnny. It's been an absolutely fascinating hour with you.
It's been great.
Kyle himself is actually off to see Star Wars right now.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
And I'm going to be going over Christmas. So all that we have left, Johnny, is your final song. What's it going to be?
Yes, it is R.E.M., Man on the Moon.
Thank you and goodbye.
Now, Andy, did you hear about this one? Tell me, are you locked in the pond? Are you goofing on out?